This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 1st of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 51st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're still recovering from overdoing it a little at our 50th birthday party last week, so this show is brought to you in association with Bloody Mary, the full English, paracetamol and the promise of an early night snoozing in front of an undemanding period drama. That's keeping us focused on the task at hand, but first, let us pique your interest, dear listeners, in our curiosity cabinet of culture in this edition. First up, I sat down with a man, the legend, John Cale, to hear about his new album and tour.
There was stuff in it that I really thought would just throw away things that really didn't matter, but it's kind of important to really, the stuff that you throw away is often the stuff that really shows your character and your personality.
We also trot over to the new look Vienna Art Fair to see whether a change has done some good.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
And ever wondered what those translators, who make the canon of Russian literature accessible to the rest of us, what do they do when they get together? Well, we attend a conference of translators to find out.
Russian literature is well known abroad for Pushkin, for Dostoevsky, but the modern Russian literature, which is equally important and equally good probably, is definitely not known.
Plus, we'll hear film director Frederick Gritton's David and Goliath tale of his new film about his old film, which stirred up more than a bit of controversy. And we'll take a tour of Buenos Aires' hottest new contemporary art gallery. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. My guest this week is John Cale, a musician synonymous with brave and brilliant experimentation, an art school attitude to rock music, a reputation for excellence, occasional impenetrability, an avant-garde place in the pantheon, a giant amongst the influences of the current canon of music of almost every type. Cale was a founder member of the Velvet Underground with Lou Reed, and on leaving the band picked up the baton proper for a mighty solo career that's explored the limits of rock, electronic and classical in collaborations with Brian Eno, John Cage, Terry Riley and Nick Drake, amongst many other greats. There's too much to put in here, really, so I'll tell you that I felt honoured to interview John on the eve of the release of his new record named, nice and cheekily, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. Here's what he had to say.
A lot of the other albums, you sit down with the guitar and you get an idea. You sit down with the piano, you get an idea. This one, you sit down with a drum kit and you get an idea. And then you get all involved in your MPC and you use your swing button to excess.
Okay.
And you try and get as much funk into it as you can.
Tell us about your swing button, because some people won't be au fait with that.
Well, there's some argument about my swing button, because...
sounds like a Nookie Wood anecdote.
That's right. You don't want to play with my swing button.
Not indeed.
You can go to boom and you can use swing and you have it at 40%. You go to somewhere else and the 40% is negotiable. So in a song like Vampire Cafe, for instance, you have a couple of grooves that collide with each other. And when I usually try and put live drums on top of the samples, a lot of drummers that they tried using, they tried to straighten out the groove because it lurches.
But that's actually what you wanted. You wanted a bit of a languorous kind of feel to it. So it's all in the swing.
Yes.
That's an unusual place to start a record with a drum kit. As you say, most people start with a guitar. You've often started with a viola. Inform the whole of the rest of the album, the place in which you start?
Yes. I mean, it gets me, my juices going quicker of the song, what the topic is, what the textures are going to be, and et cetera. So.
Brian Burton, you collaborated on a few of your songs on this new record. People know him as Danger Mouse. Mm-hmm. He's quite a kind of gauzy muddle.
Man, you have great language. Gauzy.
It's that sort of thing, isn't it? It's kind of like you're listening to it through a kind of like a screen door in an American house.
A lot of history. The history even with Danger Doom.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... Yeah, he's an interesting character, and he's very fast, which was impressive.
Is he?
Well, when you're working with computers and artists, you're always like chasing one or the other. He was always like a little step ahead of me. It was great. I mean, we got a lot of work done in about 48 hours. We were working on shortwave set, and then we knocked out these odd bits that never got finished. So I went back and finished it.
And just working with someone like that, who has a sort of similar way of disturbing the sound of records somehow.
Yeah,
that's sort of thing that you've been very well known for. How did you kind of come up against each other? Is it a beautiful?
It was a surprise because when I got the track, I had mixes of them, and then I asked, can we make a deal about the tracks? I can finish them off, fine. Yeah. And then when I got them back, there was stuff in there that I really thought would just throw away things that really didn't matter, but. It's kind of important to really, the stuff that you throw away is often the stuff that really shows your character and your personality. It's really good.
And do you know that? Are you almost expecting after half a century of doing this? Do you kind of know, you almost expect some of the offcuts to be the things that you'll make your new clothes with almost? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that happens a lot of times, yeah. The track itself is a little separate from the rest of the album because he played all the instruments on it. And he has... he plays them very differently from what I play. I hit, kind of. And he is very gentle, very sweet sort of player, and has this nice, lulling kind of Detroit feel about it.
Right.
Which is what I remember about the track, because I wanted something like that on the record, something, you know, the single tambourine, kind of, very gentle. So
you're more pugilistic, and he's more of a...
A little bit.
Right.
Not a lot, yeah.
It's going to come out in the swing button somewhere.
Yes, yeah.
Going back to the name of the record, Shifty Adventures in Knocky Wood. Do you have an idea of what it looks like, Knocky Wood, in your head when you're making these things?
When the song Knocky Wood, for instance, which where I finished the album, that's when the title has to come. Maybe it comes from the record, maybe it comes from somewhere else. But you start going through the songs and finding things. So you just need a little bow to tie it up and present it. And... that song, anyway, Knocky Wood, has a lot of strange atmospheres in it. And about a week ago, I decided to watch this film I hadn't seen in years, Blade Runner.
Right.
And I was wondering why I was so much in love with this Vietnamese girl talking in the back on a station platform. You know, and it's right there in Blade Runner. That's what I loved about Blade Runner. And you know, these sound designs that were really beautiful.
That's the thing. I mean, lots of people, it's not just sitting down. It's not sitting down with a terrifying blank page in front of you or the keys of your piano like teeth in front of you. Presumably, you can draw inspiration from everything. I mean, everything. There's all sorts of things come into that melting pot. Is that? I wonder also if there's a time of the year when you kind of realise that it's record time, when you're going to start writing. Because you've made so many records. You made 30 records.
Yeah, no, I think it goes on. I mean, the funny thing about today is that there's all this constant request for B-sides. So,
right.
You know, it's stuff that we start with about 40 songs, you cut it down to about 20, then down to 12. So then you have to go back to the stuff that you really written off for a bit and see what you can. And generally, I don't like to go back there. And generally, I start something new. And these, so it just keeps going on. I mean, I don't like being in the studio. I like the open air and getting and other things. So I've sort of taught myself to be really efficient and focus on certain things and learn when to stop. Realize at a certain point you're not going to get anywhere any further than this today.
Yeah.
So you need to get some sleep.
And when you say, because these are nice hours to keep for a musician, because there's the all night merchants, and you said you've been there before.
You know, that really shortchanges you. Because you think that you're going to get in there and you have this wonderful facility, you can record anytime you want, but you don't record anytime you want.
After a certain hour, you faff anytime. About and you don't achieve anything.
Kind of, yeah.
And where is the studio? I mean, this is...
Oh, it's in LA.
Is that an easy place to work? Do you still draw inspiration from being there?
No, I could kind of cocoon myself. I mean, these are worlds that I'm trying to
Blinds
create.
Down, Blade Runner on.
Right.
John Kell's
exactly,
at home.
Exactly, yeah.
And so there's not a lot of Los Angeles in Knocky Wood.
I'd be the last one to know anyway. But right. I don't believe there is.
That's got a bit of a Dylan Thomas vibe to it, Knocky Wood, somehow, isn't it?
I think so.
It's not.
I'll go with that.
Milkwood's not too
distant
a cousin.
Anything with Dylan Thomas's name in it.
And how long? I mean, you were quick worker. You said working with Danger Mouse was a kind of. He's pretty speedy.
So helpful.
You like that as well?
Yeah, that sixth sense. Not everybody's got that. Where you're going and what you get it right away.
Yeah, and you're obviously working with someone like him. He's very well known. He's got this sort of quality to his songs that we think we can recognise. What about when people work with you? You've collaborated with so many people over the years. Do they get a bit shy of working with you? Do they?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't done that in quite a while.
Yeah.
I mean, it was fun working with Alejandro Escovedo. Uh-huh. And because his songs have a lot of mystery to them. So you can add, I think Nico was the same, you know, they were ill-defined. And you could really dress them up any way you wanted, but, you know, we just did it our way.
It's the strength, presumably, of those people as well, of the bare bones being there and being able to dress them up any way you want.
Anytime you meet somebody like Paddy O'Rigi, you know they're not going to go away.
In a good way.
Yeah.
Because collaborators...
I mean, collaborators they're going to sustain themselves for yonks.
And I wanted to ask on that note of collaborating with people, there's obviously an amount of selfishness and self-absorption to obviously making any kind of art like this. Is it useful to have them as a sounding board? Have you ever been tempted just to get someone in to go, what do you think of this? Or do you have to be completely 100% into it yourself?
No, I have to find at some point in the process, you have to find somebody that you trust to come in and you listen. And you just play and you let them listen and listen to what they say. And you get a clear idea. Yeah, my objectivity at a certain state is not as reliable as it is at other times, and I've got to realize that when that is. But I have good people I can call in to do that, so they're very helpful.
People that will forgive.
Well,
excess use of the swing.
Yes. Or we'll encourage it.
So we're going to play I Want to Talk to You, which is going to be the first single. And you mentioned another one. Is it Vampire? Is it Mothra or Vampire Cafe that you were saying is your favourite record in the album?
Nookie Wood.
Oh, Nookie Wood.
Yeah.
The title track. But we're going to play I Want to Talk to You. Maybe you could give us a line or two on how this came to pass, John. It's a good way of opening an album.
Yes.
Shh, listen.
Hey, come here. I want to talk to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You've been accosted. It's like being accosted on a... They say never walk around in LA. This
never
is why.
One of these.
This is how I want. A conversation at a urinal in Los Angeles. This is how every great record starts.
Yeah, I try to avoid it. Yeah.
Well, I don't think it needs any further introduction than that. This from Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood, new from John Cale, is I Want to Talk to You. That was I Want to Talk to You from John Cale's new album, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. John's on tour right now, and we'll hear more from that new album later on in the show. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're off to Vienna next.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. But they help make a city. You'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Vienna is best known for performing arts like opera, theatre and orchestral music, but its best kept secret is its visual arts scene. Vienna's Art Academy is the oldest in Europe, its museums among the world's best and most handsome. And in terms of contemporary art, Vienna has a small but solid gallery world paired with an equally small but loyal collector base. For all the loyalty, there's been a lot of movement recently. Kunsthalle Wien and the MAC both have new museum directors. Francesca von Habsburg's TBA 21 Art Foundation moved to a new location. The list goes on. More shifts came earlier this year when a Russian investor bought majority holdings of the Vienna Fair Art Fair, and new artistic directors were named in the spring. So is this fair a new start for Vienna's visual art world? Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley reports.
This year's Vienna Fair has been injected with some outside energy. It's high time. Launched in 2005, the fair has never had particularly strong sales and was previously considered a regional event. A huge turning point has been its two young female artistic directors, Christina Steinbrecher, the 29-year-old Russian-German mastermind of Art Moscow, and Vita Zaman, a Lithuanian curator and gallerist with years in London and New York under her belt. Charismatic and internationally connected, the two have had only 4 months to shape this year's event, which they've subtitled The New Contemporary and which has a mission to extend the fair's reach, looking mostly toward Eastern Europe, and to increase sales. Steinbrecher explains what the old fair was and what the new plan is.
So for me, Vienna Fair was a key marketplace for Eastern Europe. Basically, the marketplace was to meet Eastern European galleries, to meet the artists, and to meet directors and key art professionals from that region, and also to touch base with Viennese, basically, galleries. I lacked the broadness of the program. It was very rational, and it was very focused on the art professional itself. So as a marketplace, it didn't quite work for the galleries due to the lack of sales, because it was very specialist and very art professional focused.
The two have a couple of strategies to bring in more buyers.
We created a broad and intensive VIP program in order to make sure that collectors come, that also art professionals come. But the marketplace, I mean, a fair has the task to sell. And if a fair doesn't sell, it's not a fair.
The fair is composed of 122 galleries from around the world, 41 of them from Vienna, a few from Berlin, two from the US, one from Dubai, six from Russia, and a group of selected galleries from Turkey. Alongside the booths filled with works by local and international artists, like art star Lawrence Wiener or Austrian feminist artist Valley Export, sit a scad of extra on-site events, as co-director Vita Zaman explains.
We curated two programs, essentially. One called Vienna Quintet, which focused on art from Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Ukraine, and Belarus. And then there was a talk program to follow that. And there was another program called Vienna Live, which was very much to do with attracting new audiences and activating the local potential of Vienna as a city, and collaborating with local artists, local students, engaging non-art activities such as yoga, cooking, psychoanalysis, and bringing them into the context of the fair, and using these activities as a material for artists to make new work that engages people, engages participants.
The fair's numbers are indeed up from last year. The 17,000 odd visitors include notable Russian collectors and VIPs, along with pretty much everyone from the Austrian scene, and a good number of curious Berliners. Even some old-school Viennese gallerists are enthusiastic, like Hubert Winter, who first opened his gallery in the city in 1971.
I remembered in 1975 there was a Viennese art fair, and it was a complete disaster. So comparing to these older art fairs, this is really a great art fair, I must say. This is perfect. I hope that the Viennese collectors will see it also, the high quality.
35-year-old Austrian collector and art consultant Florian Staudinger definitely sees the quality.
Things are just different. It looks much more organized. The booths are bigger, and it seems smarter. And we are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train. And I was actually waiting for it because it took us several years to find the way. But with this specialization of Eastern European art, I think we've found the right niche, and it's really great.
Outside the fairgrounds, the rest of the city's art world are also taking the opportunity to showcase their best. The Kunsthistorisches Museum, which has a new focus on modern and contemporary art with British curator Jasper Sharp, have opened a solo exhibition by Los Angeles art legend Ed Ruscha. 22 of Vienna's top galleries, many of them also showing in the fair, have mounted shows put together by outside curators. Zaman sees all of this as just the beginning.
Ed Ruscha first came to Austria.
I'm very, very excited, actually. And happy, I suppose, but also realistic. You know, I realize it's the beginning of work, so I see something as beginning things to come. But overall, very positive, and I see a lot of happy faces from curators, from collectors, from galleries, from artists. So it's very rewarding. At the same time, already getting ideas of what we're going to do next year.
Not everyone has been impressed. The poster, for starters, has been dubbed by some as unnecessarily sexy. There have also been grumblings about the new owner's investment fund, which bought €1 million worth of art at the fair with which to start a collection. Another question from some tired art worlders coming from Berlin Art Week the week before is, do we really need so many art fairs? American artist and writer Warren Neidick thinks this one has a place.
Vienna, if it was smart, could be a hub in a kind of place for art to be shown in which the new Europe and the old Europe mix because of history.
It also means a lot to any city's art economy and image.
A city exists in two ways now. There is the physical city, and then there's the immaterial city. So first of all, let's talk about the physical city. This, a kind of art fair like this, which is bringing people from all over the world, they have to inhabit hotel rooms, they go out to dinner, they drink at bars, they buy clothes, they forget their toothbrush, they have to buy sunglasses. There's a tremendous amount of economy that's created by the visitors who come to an art fair. The second thing is the immaterial city. It's the city as it exists in the media, on television, on all of the art media networks, magazines, and that city, it really, really is captivated by an art fair like this.
For Monocle, in Vienna, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24ington. Still to come in part two, we'll hear what happens when big boys go bananas, that's that film. We'll take a peek around Buenos Aires' latest contemporary art gallery and we'll find out what it's like to go to a party with a load of translators in Russia. You heard me. But first, let's enjoy another great track from John Cale's new album, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. This is Scotland Yard.
They'll show you mostly. City at midnight and whistling in the dark.
And that was Scotland Yard, a new from John Cale, and you are tuned in to Culture on Monocle 24. What happens to the documentary filmmaker when their controversial work causes controversy? Well, that's just what happened to Frederick Gritton when Dole Foods, the subject of his documentary Bananas, decided to sue him. Frederick made a film about 12 Nicaraguan banana plantation workers who sued the company over their use of potentially harmful chemicals. His latest film, Big Boys Gone Bananas, is about the battle that ensued. So was it a case of David versus Goliath, the moral crusade, or do documentaries work to their own narrative, sometimes omitting important details? We invited Frederick to Studio 2 at Midori House to sit down with Adrian Craddock and tell him more.
Dole Foods is suing a Swedish filmmaker for wanting to show a fraudulent documentary slamming the company.
It's totally crazy that you in the biggest democracy in the world can't even show this film. 6 weeks ago it was okay, now it's not okay.
Well, I did a film called Bananas where I followed Nicaraguan banana workers who sued Dole Food Company for the use of a banned pesticide that they claimed made them sterile. And I was following this case all the way to a verdict where actually juries said that Dole acted with malice and misconduct. And Dole was ordered to pay the workers. And that was kind of unusual in many ways to be able to follow a lawsuit that actually ends with a happy ending. That was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. This film was done in 2009, and I was about to premiere it at the LA Film Festival. And then when we announced it, we got a cease and desist letter from Dole Food Company. And the same letter was sent to every single sponsor of the LA Film Festival. And from that on, everything started to be very, very strange.
So what exactly did they have such an issue with? I mean, from my research, it seems like they put forward this argument that you've misrepresented them in some way.
Well, always very complicated, and that's a part of the game. These are lawyers, and lawyers are very good at making things look very funny and strange. The story in the film and in the court case I followed was that Dole Food Company kept using a banned pesticide when everybody told them, please stop, including Dow Chemicals told them, please stop using this because our workers are now sterile. But Dole said, no, no, send us more stuff. We want to use it.
So this pesticide actually made the workers sterile if
used. The American factory workers were sterile, and there were medical proof that you got sterile if you got in contact with this stuff.
So let's go back to that moment. So you're about to premiere your film at the LA Film Festival and this cease and desist letter comes out, what happens now? This is where it starts to go, to make a bit of a fruit pun, a bit pear-shaped, doesn't it?
I never received a letter from a US corporation before, especially not a corporation suing you. So, of course, it was really scary. And our lawyers quite early told us that if you go to LA, you have to expect getting delivered a lawsuit. But all the time I believed in the film. And also all the European broadcasters who were in this project also believed that this film is true. So, I mean, we had this corporation attacking us fiercely, but our lawyers told us there's nothing wrong with your film. But I mean, that's what I understand now, that if an entity like them, if they want to stop something, they do it anyway. They sue you anyway, even if they're not right, because by the weight of a lawsuit, they can scare people away.
And that's what happened with the LA Film Festival. They dropped your film, is that right?
LA Film Festival, they got really scared and they decided to move the film out of competition. Maybe they hoped that we would pull the film ourselves. But we decided, okay, we want to play the film. But they got really nervous, so we Dole pushed on their sponsors, you know. In the midst of the financial crisis, they sent a letter to every sponsor of the festival. I mean, that was the CEO of LA Times, the CEO of American Airlines. All these people got the same cease and desist letter. You can imagine all the energy that goes around that. It's a very aggressive tactics. It's actually never seen or heard of in the American movie industry before. Even if you have had so many lawsuits over there, this was of a new scale in many ways. So it really scared people.
So what he's doing here is he's equating your film to a propaganda piece that was trying to essentially justify the massacre of Jews.
Well, it seems like this new film, Big Boys Gone Bananas, is the fight back. This is your answer to all the criticism.
Well, for me, the film is, of course, bigger than my fight with Dole, because it is the story about media in modern times. Because how do they do? This is kind of the checklist of taking down a critic or a whistleblower. So I think everybody who watches film can also understand the techniques. Not only in my case, they can also just see how do you do it. I mean, it's the PR company. They have their little war room. They say, okay, this is the filmmaker and this is his friends. Who are our friends? How should we do it? And then they play the game. And you're up against so many people. Imagine, they contacted every journalist that interviewed me. Mm-hmm. And in Sweden, that was insane because our story went quite big in my own country. And they contacted everybody. You can imagine how much money they spent. I mean, if they spend $1 million only in lawyers, they'll probably spend more money in PR to take down the film. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of money. And we are a small four-people company. So it's no fun, and it's not a PR stunt, and it's not a macho thing. It's just terrible. And a corporation doing that kind of in many ways also shows that they belong to a different era.
As you say, this film covers the media frenzy that surrounded this film, Bananas. Do you feel like this has almost backfired for Dole? Because no one, as far as a media narrative goes, no one ever wants to see a David and Goliath battle where, you know, Goliath wins. You know, no one wants to see the big corporation knuckle down on the little guy. Mm. Do you think it's a fair thing to say that, you know, it has backfired? No one is on their side on this one.
It has backfired in the longer perspective. In the short perspective, Dole won in the US. And maybe that was important for them. So, I mean, the film Bananas, we had sold the TV rights in the US. It was never broadcasted. I mean, we got distribution in the end, but it was kind of too late. So in their own home country, they won. In Sweden, they definitely lost. And in some other countries, you know, it doesn't really matter because it's not really in the news media. And in my own country, they are still losing. I mean, people are really upset still. And I mean, so it's a good thing. And hopefully other corporations will learn from that, you know. Sure. Okay, there is a risk you can backfire because people don't like when the big guy is kind of attacking the small guy because it's not a fair game.
When you approach this new film, you know, you've been through a pretty traumatic time, you know, personally through your experiences with Bananas. Did you have any kind of apprehensions as you approach this new film? Were you nervous to go after this subject again? I mean, I know you're not going after the exact subject again, but to even involve this company in a film again?
I think, I mean, if we have freedom of speech and free press in our constitutions, and if we don't use it, what's the point of having it? Our experience is a great story, you know? If you have a great story as a journalist, what do? Do you kill it or you write it? I mean, this is a great story. I had to tell it.
They spend millions on their brand every year, and you're going to come in and start attacking their brand. What did you think was going to happen?
That was Frederick Gritton speaking to Adrian Craddock, and his film, Big Boys Gone Bananas, is out in cinemas now. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's Monocle 24. We're off to Russia next to hang out with some translators. Stay tuned.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back to Culture. Now, how many translated books have you read? If you add them all up, you might be surprised, but you also might have to look a long way back to your school days. Modern translated works are not that widely read, except for bestsellers like Stieg Larsson, Carlos Ruiz Zafón, Muriel Barbery, or Roberto Bolaño. And the chances are, you've never read a contemporary Russian author. That's despite the fact that classics by Dostoevsky and Tolstoy are among the most translated works in the world. But, as Peter van Dijk reports from Moscow, this discrepancy is something the Russian government wants to fix.
Translator Michelle Birdie recalls how she found out that Russian plates don't lie or even sit on a table. She's speaking at a seminar during the second International Literary Translators Conference in Moscow. Her audience knows all too well what she's talking about. Plates are flat, Birdie says, but they stand. Anyone working in two languages has a funny story like this. In fact, anyone who has read a translated menu while on vacation probably has one. But translation is a serious business, and at long last, the Russian government is taking an interest. Konstantin Kosachov is the head of Russia's Agency for International Humanitarian Cooperation. After his speech at the opening of the conference, he explained why the government wants to get foreigners reading more Russian literature.
Russian literature is well known abroad for Pushkin, for Dostoevsky, for other great writers and poets. But the modern Russian literature, which is equally important and equally good probably, is definitely not known. But for many people could be another key for accessing real Russia, Russia of today.
In his previous job as chairman of the Russian Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, Kosachev was frequently called upon to put Russia's viewpoints to Western media. Now he's pushing a more subtle approach. About time too, says Julia Guman.
For many years there have practically been no support at all, financial support of translations from Russian into foreign languages. So this new venture of the Ministry of Mass Communication hopefully will last and will help to further promote publications in translation from Russian.
Guman founded the Banka Guman and Smirnova Literary Agency, which promotes Russian writers abroad.
I think for any government, for any state in the world, it's important to communicate oneself. And obviously for Russia, these days, it's crucial to be able to explain what's going on. And for our agency, it's quite important to be able to introduce new names, young authors, so that we could really explain what's going on in Russia these days.
Guman says it is very difficult to get a Russian author published abroad. She hopes government funding for new translations will make it easier. Translator Marianne Schwartz says this is the perfect time for Russia to push its young talent onto the global stage.
Russian literature since the breakup of the Soviet Union has gone through a metamorphosis, and at this point we have a whole generation of young writers who are of very high quality, of an extraordinary range of styles and genres, who will translate well and who will find an audience in the West if they can get translated and published.
But a lot depends on the translator.
A good translator is, by definition, non-existent. He dissolves in the original text.
Alexander Livergant is editor-in-chief of the magazine Inostranaya Literatura, or Foreign Literature, which was first published in the 1950s. He is also a translator.
You don't have to be an author to be a good translator. But sometimes, you know, since a translator is a literary man, in the first place, I should say, more often than not, he is an author.
In the Soviet era, some great translations were done by writers who found it hard to get their own works published. Poet Anna Akhmatova was one celebrated example, and Boris Pasternak's translations of Shakespeare are unsurpassed, Russians say. Deep down, they may even secretly believe Pasternak's plays are better than the originals. Times have changed, though. Livergant warns that translating contemporary works is even harder than translating the classics.
To be able to translate properly and artistically a book by contemporary Russian authors, it will take you to know Russian life very well. In order to do that, very many agents and publishers and translators are invited some nowadays to Russia, you know, to look around.
And, says Marianne Schwartz, you have to know what's being written in your native language too.
You have to know the idiom in order to recreate the contemporary Russian. For example, a novel I translated called Thirst was about Chechen war vets. And, of course, soldiers have their own blasphemous and scatological and every other kind of slang and obscenity. But in order for Americans to understand that, you had to use a lot of slang that our soldiers use. I used fuck and fucking much more than it's used in Russian, but that's how our soldiers talk.
Andrei Galasimov's Thirst does not paint a pretty picture of modern Russia, and perhaps that will create dilemmas for officials deciding which translation proposals deserve state funding. But, says Noah Berkstedt-Breen of the London-based Sputnik Theatre Company, there are signs that the Russian government may be willing to take a risk or two. Berkstedt-Breen believes officials see the translated Russian plays he puts on as oppositional. Nevertheless, he got state funding to attend the translators' conference.
Some playwrights write very directly about what's going on here, very political work. Other playwrights are very imaginative and give maybe a flavour of the Russian character without necessarily directly engaging with what's going on here. So it does vary a lot, but for sure it makes people interested in Russia. They want to know more about it. Maybe they'll eventually become interested enough to then to travel here or that kind of thing. So I think it definitely is PR. I know it's not as obvious PR as advertising, but it is cultural PR.
Cultural PR. It doesn't sound like a natural fit for the Kremlin, but the translators at the conference hope officials really give it a go. The New Russia, coming to a bookstore near you. For Monocle in Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Off to South America now to round off the show. Back to the art world too, because Monocle's man in Argentina, Ed Stocker, visited the latest addition to Buenos Aires' burgeoning and confident contemporary scene, the Museum of Contemporary Art. It's known as MACPA and opened in the south of town last month.
It's not every day that a city gets a new museum. Rarer still, one that boasts works from Joan Miró, Kenneth Noland and Sarah Morris. The newly built museum is a modernist ode to concrete, glass and steel, set over six floors. Housed in the southern Buenos Aires neighbourhood of San Telmo, Macba is the brainchild of Aldo Rubino, a businessman who always dreamed of a public home for his collection.
I've been collecting for many years, and the idea to make a museum was to share with people what I'm collecting for 20 years. I don't believe in the collections keep it behind the doors. I think that each artwork is like a human being, so I think that the best happens for an artwork is to be shared with the people and the interaction between them.
An entirely private venture, Macba is currently showing 50 of the 150 pieces that Rubino, an Argentinian banker based in Miami, has amassed over the years. The collection is a fascinating history lesson, a deftly chosen sample of contemporary art from the second half of the 20th century, with a focus on the geometric and abstract.
The actual exhibition is very international and is divided in four areas. Each one represents some movement inside the geometric abstraction. The floor we are right now, this is the first floor, is talking about the color, and the second, that is the main floor, is talking about the op art. Then we have another floor that is talking about the shaped canvases. And the last one is about the new trends.
The decision to open in San Telmo is interesting, away from the establishment neighborhoods of Recoleta and Palermo. But the move makes sense, argues Rubino. The area is popular with an international artsy crowd, something that ties in well with the collection. It's also further proof that the Argentinian capital's southern barrios, including La Boca and Barracas, as well as San Telmo, are giving the richer north a run for its money. Alicia de Artiaga is an art critic for La Nación, Argentina's longest-running newspaper. The daily's busy newsroom is located downtown.
I think that the new Macba is a landmark for the city because it's the first private museum only for abstract art, contemporary, and from Latin America, and also for the rest of the world.
But De Artiaga also recognizes that the small walls may be a problem in the future, because contemporary art is often dominated by large canvases.
On the other hand, I think that the museum is perfect, but maybe in the future there are a problem with the size of the paintings, because if you choose something that is very big, it's impossible to take because the ceiling is not so high. Aldo Rubino told me that it's very difficult in this part of the city, that is a historic district, to build very high building. It's a limit. He wants to have six floors. The ceiling is not so high. But now it's not a problem. Abstract, contemporary, and no in a big size is perfect. But I think it's a question for the future.
The museum may show artists from all over the world, but there's also a strong Latin American influence. Here is the chance to see works by renowned Argentinian artists such as Guillermo Kitka and the Paris-based Juan Melet, alongside pieces from the UK, US and Germany. Intriguingly, Macba has opened next to the city-funded Museum of Modern Art, or MAMBA, two museums that show the stark difference between public and private funding in the capital.
There are two situations in these two museums, that is one next to the other. Then you know the Macba is building a 1 year, this extraordinary museum. Next door, the MAMBA, Museo Arte Moderno de Buenos Aires, took 11 years rebuilding this museum for a very modest reform.
Despite the problems neighbouring MAMBA has faced during its refurbishment, Rubino would welcome the chance to work with the city and join the list of museums it supports. He's also looking into forming partnerships at home and overseas so his collection can travel. Okay, now you wanted to show me one of the most important pictures in the exhibition, so shall we walk over and have a look at it?
Yes, of course. So we are here in the first floor. We will talk about the work we have of the Venezuelan artist Carlos Cruz Diaz. He's maybe the most important artist in the world alive for color theory. The work we have is from 1967. This is the most important piece we have in the collection. You can see, as long as you walk through the work that is almost 4 meters, you will see the color changing from a light red to intense red. And you will see also changing the figures. You will see on the back like the squares and rectangles with different colors in green and light blues and oranges, so it's very optic.
Next year, the museum plans to host retrospectives for local artists Manuel Espinosa and Maria Martorell, and there will also be an Italian-themed exhibition. Macba is a vivid assault on the senses. The colours and the shapes test the eyes and invite interpretations. For culture vultures in the Argentinian capital, the rich pickings just got richer. For Monaco and Buenos Aires, I'm Ed Stocker.
So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be preparing for Freeze Masters by asking, how do you frame the bloody things, among other things? You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. My producer was Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher deserves a medal for her intricate editing and mixing work. Time for one final song this week from the wonderful John Cale's wonderful album, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. This is Hemingway. Thanks for tuning in.